Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a looming showdown in the United States Senate as Democrats try to force the Republican Obamacare replacement bill out into the open from its behind-closed-door negotiations by Republicans, whose Senate leader hopes to jam it through using the reconciliation process to avoid a filibuster. Joining us is a veteran Senate staffer, Paul Light, professor of public service at New York University, who was director of the Government Studies Program at the Brookings Institution and is the author of Government by Investigation, Presidents, Congress, and the Search for Answers, 1945 to 2012. We will discuss the many tactics that can slow down the Senate and the likelihood that when the Republican health care bill sees the light of day and is scored by the CBO, moderate Republicans will abandon it, as well as try to figure out Trump's tweet calling the bill mean and what effect that might have on its uncertain future. Then we'll examine the latest disarray caused by Trump's tweets attacking the Deputy Attorney General for initiating an investigation of him, which Trump calls a witch hunt, only to have his lawyer say the president is not being investigated at the same time saying he is. James Kirchick, a fellow with the Foreign Policy Initiative in Washington, D.C., and author of The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age, joins us to discuss his article at the Los Angeles Times. If Trump were really in league with Russia, that would be reassuring for America's civic sanity, and why he thinks it is unlikely that Trump will be found guilty of collusion with the Russians, and how the various investigations serve to distract us from the fact that Trump is guilty of being an unscrupulous, unpatriotic demagogue. Then finally, we will look into a terror attack in London in which 9 worshippers leaving a North London mosque were seriously injured by a van driven by a father of 4 from Cardiff, who told the group of Muslims who held him until the police arrived that, "You deserve it," and "I did my bit." Charles Kurzman, the co-director of the Carolina Center for the Study of Middle East and Muslim Civilizations, joins us to discuss how this attack is exactly what the Islamic State was hoping to provoke in response to its terrorist attacks designed to drive a wedge between Muslims in the diaspora and their host countries. And joining us now is Paul Light, who is the Paul Light Goddard Professor of Public Service at New York University and the founding principal investigator of the Global Center for Public Service. Previously, he served as the founding director of the Center for Public Service and director of the Governmental Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. He's the author of Thickening Government and the Tides of Reform, and his latest book is Government by Investigation, Presidents, Congress, and the Search for Answers, 1945 to 2012. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Light.
Nice to be with you.
Well, thank you, Paul. And what do you think is going to happen tonight in the Senate? The Republicans are clearly nervous about the secret negotiations going on about the health care bill that they got from the House. And the Democrats are sort of trying to force it out into the open. And the Republicans have even gone so far as to thinking about restricting television interviews in the hallways of the Capitol last week. They're obviously very nervous. But what can the Democrats do to gum up the works or to force the hand of Mitch McConnell to let the public know what's going on behind closed doors?
Well, they can make life very painful for the majority leader as well as his followers. The Senate is finally calibrated to inflict pain when there's not unanimous consent. It operates by unanimous consent, which means that all 100 members must agree to debate. Now, there are tools available to the majority to end run those requirements, but, you know, the minority does have the ability to slow things down and make it very painful to move forward. And that's what the minority is going to do, and they probably have 2 or 3 votes in their hip pocket from Republican moderates. So this is a real stare down between the Democrats and Republicans at this point.
Well, this group called Indivisible that's been very effective in terms of the resistance that's growing against the Trump administration, Ezra Levin, the co-founder, tweeted last week that the Democrats could introduce an almost infinite number of amendments that would choke the Senate calendar indefinitely until they got what they wanted. Is that a viable strategy?
It is a viable strategy, but you have to be very gentle. What goes around comes around, and there's a little bit of that here. There were hundreds of open hearings on Obamacare, but at the end of the day, you had to push it through. And here are the Republicans coming with a bill drafted by 15 men, trying to jam it through, and you can slow this thing down. You can make it very painful, and you can chock the pipeline full of amendments. You can make it very painful. At the end of the debate, there is a vote, and everything hinges on whether or not the Democrats can pick up a couple of votes or can create a credible threat that they have a couple of votes and force this bill out, force review by the Congressional Budget Office, and we'll see what it actually does. And I think that's going to have to happen sooner or later. I just think the Senate has to be a little bit more open, and I think that's going to win the day.
But it sounds like that Democrats might be working at cross purposes. If on the one hand you want to win over the moderates like Murkowski and others,
right,
you don't want to annoy them or raise their partisan hackles. But on the other hand, the strategies to force them out from behind closed doors that Ezra Levin and others are suggesting makes life uncomfortable for senators. They don't like to have to be called back and spend the whole night on the floor, do they?
Well, of course not. But Susan Collins, for example, was a longtime staffer in the United States Senate. She's seen it before. Murkowski is the daughter of a long-serving senator. She has a good memory of what goes on. I think you go into the Senate and you understand that there are maneuvers and that this is the saucer that cools the House. And at the end of the day, McConnell could pay a very heavy price for jamming something through. He's been trying to protect prerogatives for a while now, and at some point he's got to decide whether he wants this health bill enough after the President of the United States has cut the legs out from under their secret stool by saying the bill is mean, mean, mean. You know, whether McConnell really wants to go to the wall with this is not entirely assured at this particular point.
And again, I'm speaking with Paul Light, who's the Paulette Goddard Professor of Public Service at New York University and the founding principal investigator of the Global Center for Public Service. Previously, he served as the founding director of the Center for Public Service and director of the Governmental Studies Program at the Brookings Institution, and is the author of Thickening Government and the Tides of Reform. And his latest book is Government by Investigation, Presidents, Congress, and the Search for Answers, 1945 to 2012. And of course, you yourself, Paul, have had a long history with the Senate, having worked for Senator John Glenn. And you also worked for a Republican, didn't you?
Yes, on the House side. I worked on Social Security reform, which was a nail biter. But at the end of the day, you know, McConnell has to decide that he really wants this and that he thinks it can pass. And if he pushes too far, he can drive some of his more moderate members towards a really tough decision on with whom they wish to caucus. It's not inevitable here that some of the Republicans on his in his caucus are going to stay with him if he pushes too hard. So there's a lot of high wire behavior here right now, and I tend to believe that the Democrats are going to force this thing out in the open, and once they do, you're going to see a score from the Congressional Budget Office, and it ain't going to look good. And even if Republicans get this enacted, you're going to have a score, and they're going to have to run on it. Now, they've got an advantage going into 2018. A lot of Democrats up for re-election and very few Republicans, but that doesn't matter here. This is a long haul, and I think that McConnell is taking a very significant risk in trying to push this forward, and I suspect that he's got a plan B. I don't know what it is, but he can only push his members so far.
But what's going on with President Trump tweeting out that the Republican bill is mean, mean, mean? I thought he was the one that wanted an achievement. He wanted to look like he was getting something done. And if he's undercutting what Mitch McConnell's doing in secret, that's not helpful.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, he's feeling the burn, and I don't mean Bernie Sanders. You know, he's looking at the polling. He knows that his popularity is low. He's not rational to the traditional level of presidential calculators like Lyndon Johnson and so forth, but he understands that this bill is unpopular among a significant segment of Americans and that it cross-cuts his promises in some states like West Virginia. So you've got Democrats up for re-election in states where you've also got a fair degree of pain if this particular bill and its imagined form passes. So Trump has to walk the tight rope as well. And given all that's on his agenda and the tremendous amount of focus on his own behavior, does he really want a battle over this bill? Does he really want to fight to the end to get a measure that's going to that he's going to have to live with for 4 years? It's going to be implemented in 2020, according to the latest conversations. 2020 happens to be the year he stands for re-election. So you've got a lot going on here. It is a very difficult choice to make, and I suspect the Democrats are going to pull it out.
Well, you know that they're working on the House bill. We know what that, how bad that was. We also know that you've got people like Rand Paul, who are these sort of, you know, uber libertarians who simply don't believe in any public role in just about anything. So it's hard to know what's going on in these closed door meetings, how McConnell is being pushed to and fro. And of course, he's undercut by, as we mentioned, by the president himself tweeting out the bill is mean, mean, mean. So, but my problem, Paul Light, is that as much as this is an opportunity for the Democrats, they don't seem to ever be able to sell what, I mean, Obama was terrible at selling the Affordable Care Act. And now, in spite of him, a lot of people like it. And if they go after Medicaid and Medicare, which is, you know, often thought of as a poor people's program, particularly Medicaid, lots and lots of middle-class people, elderly people, depend upon it in retirement homes. This is really going to cause a lot of pain, and I don't understand why the Democrats aren't making that case.
Well, I think they are. I think what the Democrats lack right now is a credible response to the argument that the insurance exchanges are collapsing. Democrats say frequently that the program needs fixing, not repeal. But I haven't seen anything from the Democrats that goes to the heart of a fix. And if you want to go, you know, punch by punch, you need to have something that Republicans could warm up to as a credible fix to Obamacare. You can't beat something with nothing, even in the United States Senate. So if it's resistance 24-7, I don't think Democrats have a sustainable case. They may win this vote, but sooner or later they're going to be called to account for what they've got if these insurance exchanges collapse. So, I mean, this is an issue perfectly designed to trigger all of the circuit breakers in the United States Senate. You don't have a rule. You don't have the power to just jam it through. You can slow it down to cold molasses speed, subglacial speed. You can make it very painful. You can make the Republicans defend their basic operating style, notwithstanding the bill, to be accused of doing this in secret. That may go for the House, but in this particular moment, when the public is concerned about secrecy in the White House, Republicans want to risk that. So I just think at some point this is a game of chicken where the Republicans blink first.
And we still can't figure out what's going on with the president. I mean, it's certainly not an open invitation for him to work with the Democrats, is it?
Oh, no. No, I don't think so. I think that he flits in and out on these kinds of issues. He's an unreliable ally. He's a fickle adversary. I don't think he is a significant force in this debate, and I'm not sure there's much left in the tank until these investigations are cleared for any issue. His tax plan, his budget cuts, the Senate and the House have both declared his budget cuts dead on arrival. I mean, this is a presidency in high speed, and it feels like the end of a presidency more than the beginning. We're all exhausted by it. There's a sense that we're just grinding through issue after issue every hour. It really is exhausting, and I think he's irrelevant at this particular point on Capitol Hill. What can he give you that you need? You want him to show up in your district to campaign for you? Well, there's a minority that would like that, but it's not the majority any longer.
And in terms of McConnell, though, talk about the pot calling the kettle black. I mean, he's played hardball in ways that he's actually pushed the envelope more than anybody that I can recall, particularly on the Supreme Court holding up Justice Garland and having him twist in the wind.
He's a gifted tactician, but, you know, at the end of the day, you got to count votes. And the Senate has a distinguished history of stalemate, and you cannot, with good hope, strong hope, argue that you need a closed process. It just is very, very difficult, and they may get the bill, but I would bet against it. I think the odds are pretty good against it.
Well, but just in closing, the fact that it's being closed indicates when you do things behind in the back room, the smoke-filled room behind closed doors, it's always the suggestion always is that, you know, you're colluding to try and do something that's nasty as opposed to opening it up to the light of day for all.
Well, it's a perfect call to a classic slogan. What are you hiding?
Right.
Is it really that bad? It's a 2,000-page bill. Nobody can read. What are you hiding? Then you get the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office score. 23 million Americans knocked off the insurance rolls. 21. I mean, what's a good number for the Republicans on this? What's the cost savings? What's the cost, sort of human health and so forth? So, you know, I don't see the Republicans coming out of this in good shape one way or the other. It's kind of like winning a round but losing the match, that kind of thing.
Well, Paul Leiter, thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Leiter, who's the Paulette Goddard Professor of Public Service at New York University and the founding principal investigator of the Global Center on Public Service. Previously, he served as the founding director of the Center for Public Service and director of the Governmental Studies Program at the Brookings Institution, and is the author of Thickening Government and the Tides of Reform. And his latest book is Government by Investigation, Presidents, Congress, and the Search for Answers, 1945 to 2012. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into whether the various investigations into Donald Trump serve to distract us from the fact that Trump is guilty of being an unscrupulous, unpatriotic demagogue.
And so no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. All we've got, no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. More money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth. And those pills make me.
Well, I know what's right. I got just one life. In a world that keeps on pushing me around, but I'll stand my ground.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Gerchik, who's a journalist and foreign correspondent who's reported from Southern and North Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, across the European continent, and the Caucasus. He's a fellow with the Foreign Policy Initiative in Washington, D.C., a correspondent for The Daily Beast, and a columnist for Tablet. And his latest book, Just out is The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age. And he has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times. If Trump were really in league with Russia, that would be reassuring for America's civic sanity. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Kirchick.
Thank you for having me.
And our civic sanity is not being salved in any way, least of all by the president himself. I mean, he's tweeting out over the weekend that there's a witch hunt against him and blaming, without naming Rod Rosenstein, the acting deputy attorney general, for appointing the special prosecutor who he recommended. And in general, Trump's people have gone on the Sunday talk shows to defend him, and they've kind of made matters worse, even digging the hole deeper. So in terms of civic sanity, the one thing that from day one that would have made this thing disappear is if Donald Trump would have stood up before the American people and said, look, I don't want to be helped by the Russians. I don't think they should be interfering in our elections. It's an attack on us. It's an attack on our democracy. And this has to stop. And we have to investigate it. And I'm absolutely furious. And I don't want to be the president of the United States who is considered illegitimate because Vladimir Putin got me the job. I mean, there's so many reasons why Trump himself could have ended this thing from day one.
Well, I just don't think he sees the world that way, because he doesn't really have values in his foreign policy. So he doesn't really see Russia as being an adversary or a problem. He has real admiration for someone like Vladimir Putin. He thinks that Russia can be an ally. And so when Russia was interfering to attack Hillary Clinton and help him, you know, he was looking for, at it from a very selfish perspective. It was helping him. They're his friends. So then why should he complain? He's basically, he's unable to separate his own political interests from that of the country's interests. So in this case, his political interests were helped by Russia, and therefore America's interests were helped by Russia. But I don't necessarily think that just because he has this kind of perverse worldview, and is which is unpatriotic, as I described it, that doesn't necessarily mean that he was colluding. And that's why I'm skeptical that there's going to be evidence produced of his collusion. If there is, then we should obviously see it. But, you know, it's been about a year that this has been going on, that these connections to Russia or that the meddling in our elections took place. You have basically every media outlet in the world has been devoting countless resources to this story. And then you have multiple government investigations going on. They've been unable to produce any evidence of any collusion. So I just am skeptical that it's, you know, suddenly going to come about.
Well, I think the one area where an investigation would be worthwhile, and I'm not entirely sure who's doing it, and I'm assuming it's coming under Mueller's purview, but FinCEN, of course, of the Treasury Department, has all the resources to do forensic investigations into money laundering, particularly from Russia. And it would seem to me you could make the case that Donald Trump's business empire in many ways has been a kind of money laundering operation, because when he got blackballed by the Wall Street banks who were taking him down in a series of bankruptcies, he turned to the Russians. And you know, all these characters coming over, getting apartments and stuff like that in the Trump Towers, etc. I know it's all anecdotal. I mean, it's not, none of it's
right.
been properly tied together, but it does seem that he, as a businessman, once he lost the source of money from legitimate means, he might well have turned to people who need to unload their ill-gotten gains and launder them through real estate in Manhattan.
No, absolutely. But again, where's the beef? You know, where's the evidence? The FBI is looking at this. There's multiple congressional investigations looking at this. I'm sure they have the capabilities of finding this information out. And, you know, just because some dodgy Russians were buying, you know, condos in his tower, that doesn't necessarily mean that there was collusion in the election. It's a very specific term, a specific meaning. And I'm just skeptical that we're going to find it.
So in other words, if this were a judgment on a person's decency, morality, and ethics, this guy would be toast, right?
Of course.
But this is a different and higher bar, right? This is the impeachment bar, high crimes and misdemeanors, even though it's essentially political. At this moment, they're looking for crimes, and you don't think they're going to find any.
Well, I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a forensic investigator. But as I said, there are no shortage of people looking into this, and they've yet to find anything. But like exactly as you said, there's nothing illegal about being an unethical, unscrupulous, unpatriotic demagogue. And that's what Donald Trump is. That's how he behaved during the campaign. Let's not forget, he openly called upon the Russians to hack his opponent. He praised Vladimir Putin. He speculated that we might just reward the Russians by lifting sanctions over what they've done in Crimea. And this, you know, this bothered a lot of people. I wrote about it. I complained about it. But it didn't bother enough for him to lose the election. And that, to me, is more worrisome, the fact that all of this was purely publicly out in the open. He made no secret of his affinities for Putin. And it didn't matter to enough of the American public for them not to choose him to be president.
And again, I'm speaking with James Kirchick, who's a journalist and foreign correspondent who has reported from southern North Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, across the European continent and the Caucasus. He's a fellow with the Foreign Policy Initiative in Washington, D.C., a correspondent for The Daily Beast and columnist for Tablet. And his latest book just out is The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age. And he has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times. If Trump were really in league with Russia, that would be reassuring for America's civic sanity. Now, you just nailed the point that absolutely mystifies me, James Kirchick, and that is what's happened to the kind of moral compass and also the political battle lines have been turned on their head. You've got right-wing former Republican red baiters and Soviet haters making excuses for Putin. You've got left-wing people normally suspicious of the CIA, hoping they'll find the smoking gun, etc. But in general, as you just pointed out, people voted for this guy, and they don't seem to be bothered by the idea that somebody else, some foreign adversary, might have manipulated the whole thing. And your vote as an American, I mean, that's pretty much what Comey said in his hearings. He said, you know, it really bothered him, the idea that somebody else was making our choices for us. You know, he said, we can fight amongst ourselves and have the most vigorous debates as Americans. But the idea that somebody that's not an American decides America's election should really get people up in arms. But it hasn't.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think, you know, Marco Rubio was a rare exception, and he said very much the same thing during the campaign, that he warned his fellow Republicans, saying, look, guys, you know, today it's the Democrats who are having their emails hacked, but tomorrow it could be us. But, I mean, just the rank partisanship during the election, I think, determined a lot of this. I think a lot of people were more concerned by, you know, beating Hillary Clinton or opposing their opposing the member of the other party's candidate for president than they were with protecting the integrity of our electoral system. So I think, you know, partisanship has basically run amok to the point where people look at their fellow Americans as being a greater enemy and a greater adversary than they do a foreign hostile power. And that is a shame. And it's something I'm deeply worried about. And I think, in a sense, Putin has already won by getting us to behave this way, or just by seeing us behave this way.
Well, of course, we now know that that Marco Rubio has made a deal with Trump. I'll back off asking tough questions in these various hearings and investigations on the committee that I sit on, the Intelligence Committee, if I get my way with the Miami Cubans to bring back the blockade. So at least that's a suspicion a lot of people have. But you touched on Putin himself. So is this a situation now? I think a lot of analysts exaggerate Putin's cleverness, and I'm not sure he's too clever for his own good. First of all, a lot of his seasoned advisors clearly were against meddling, going back a few years, including his chief of staff, Ivanov, who was a very senior person in the KGB. And remember, Putin himself was a pretty minor player and a kind of wannabe, frankly. I think he's just basically too clever by half here. But to give him at least credit, essentially, He hated Hillary Clinton. This is what Comey said.
Yeah.
He hated Hillary Clinton, didn't want her elected, thought she'd get elected, didn't think Trump had a chance, but he thought he'd just make life miserable for her and have her inherit a very divided and angry country, and the idea being to weaken America. But now it looks like he succeeded beyond all measure, because if he wanted to weaken America, Trump's your guy. I mean, he's only, what, 150 days in, and the country's totally whipsawed every day by insanity. And I don't see this thing lasting. This is just like watching a train wreck in slow motion.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And as I said in my column in the LA Times, I think that's why the Russians basically supported him, was that this is a man who's sort of a walking, talking chaos candidate. And that's what Jeb Bush called him, right? The chaos candidate. And now he's become the chaos president. And he makes America look foolish. He makes us look untrustworthy. He's someone who attacked our allies throughout the campaign. He basically makes it difficult for America to be a world leader. And I think that is ultimately why the Russians wanted him to win and why they worked to that goal.
Well, but what about us and our people? I mean, what can happen to make the Republicans regain some of their lost dignity? I mean, I mentioned how Marco Rubio has essentially been bought off by the White House, and he's got payback over his Cuba deal, or killing Obama's Cuba deal. And I'm sure we'll see him. And in fact, in the last hearing, he really was seen to be advocating for Trump. But the others, I mean, at what point, is there any patriotism there amongst
Well, I mean, look, the Congress itself is still resolute on the question of Russia. I mean, you've seen that the sanctions on Russia are being maintained. NATO has been expanded. You see in Syria, I mean, where clearly there's a more aggressive stance being taken against Russian assets in Syria by the U.S. military. So I'm not necessarily sure yet that we've seen a total capitulation to Russia on the part of Republicans yet. I mean, certainly to the extent that they supported Trump, it was, regretful, in my opinion. It's not what I would have wanted. But I don't think that they've necessarily, sold the story yet.
Well, but going back to Jeb Bush, remember that all the Republican establishment were against Trump, and Jeb Bush was their best hope, and he didn't obviously do very well. What happened to those people? What happened to that idea that the party of Lincoln is now led by this reckless buffoon who is endangering America and the world?
Well, I mean, a lot of Republicans feel that way. His approval ratings are going down. I just think there was a determination on the part of many people that they thought Hillary Clinton would be worse. That wasn't an analysis that I agreed with. But I think that that's the conclusion that many people made. And they, held their nose and they voted for Trump.
Well, apparently in private, a lot of them are decrying what's going on.
Yeah.
But they don't have the guts to do it in public. So I guess he's got some leverage with his base, and that seems to be his main tactic, isn't it, to shore up his base so that he can still have the attack dogs that'll primary you if you don't support the dear leader, as they all were forced to do in that cabinet meeting. I don't know whether you saw that, but my God.
Yeah.
That seems to be
the strategy, whether or not that will be sufficient to win re-election in 3.5 years, I'm not sure.
Well, what do you think is the chance then of you don't think that this inquiry is going to go anywhere, and that I guess your advice to the Democrats would be to get a life, right? Stop counting on this.
Don't assume that you're going to be able to impeach Trump based upon some smoking gun. I fully support these investigations, and they should be continued, and to the full extent until all the evidence has been exhausted. I just wouldn't count on them, turning up evidence of treasonable offenses. That's all.
Right. But isn't there there's a sort of split here in many, many people in the so-called resistance and on the political left keep talking about that he has all kinds of psychiatric problems and perhaps even has brain damage and all of this stuff about who he is. and how appalling he is. And then on the other hand, there's the other fact is what he is doing. And it would seem to me that people in the opposition or the resistance, surely they should be focusing on what he's doing. About who he is, there's nothing he can do about that anymore, right? And unless, of course, they're counting on the idea that he's going to do some public meltdown.
You know, I agree. There's only so far you can go with those personal complaints. I mean, look, if someone, I think Donald Trump has revealed himself. I think we, you know, if you haven't been able to form your opinion of the man over the past year and a half, then you're probably, you know, not paying any attention whatsoever. So there's only so much that, you know, repeated assertions of the man's temperament, how bad it is and how irrationally he behaves. There's only so far you can go with that kind of analysis with the electorate. I think it's clear to the American people what sort of person he is. And, you know, he certainly, you know, doesn't need any prodding from Democrats or commentary from Democrats to elucidate his character to the public. He certainly, you know, he acts out on a frequent basis.
But meanwhile, he is getting things done. And I take it, just in closing, that's what people should be focused on. What's being done?
The policies, yes. I mean, he's been explicit on his policies. He hasn't, you know, he certainly hasn't accomplished that much. But he's very explicit on the policies. And I think the opposition should be doing a better job explaining why his policies don't make sense. You know, why is it not a good idea to build a wall? Why is it not a good idea to, you know, alienate our allies in Europe or to provoke a trade war with Germany and whatnot? These are all very meaty subjects that are worthy of discussion, and I think people can be persuaded on them.
Well, James Kirchick, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with James Kirchick, who's a journalist and foreign correspondent, who's reported from Southern and North Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, across the European continent and the Caucasus. He's a fellow with the Foreign Policy Initiative in Washington, D.C., a correspondent for The Daily Beast and a columnist for Tablet, and his latest book just out is The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age. And he has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times. If Trump were really in league with Russia, that would be reassuring for America's civic sanity. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into a terror attack on worshippers leaving a mosque in North London. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Charles Kurzman, a professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and co-director of the Carolina Center for the Study of the Middle East and Muslim Civilizations. He's the author of The Missing Martyrs and The Unthinkable Revolution in Iran, and the editor of the anthologies Liberal Islam and Modernist Islam, 1840 to 1940. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Kurzman.
Thanks very much for having me.
And there was an incident in front of the Finsbury Mosque in London, a fairly infamous mosque, if you will, for prior radical preachings. But in this case, a van drove into a group of people leaving the mosque. And in Virginia, a young girl, apparently, according to her father, she's coming home from McDonald's with her friend, and she was killed. The father believes she was killed. He was 100% sure that she was killed because she is a Muslim. So isn't the idea of the strategy, if you will, for the Daesh, the Islamic State, in conducting these horrific attacks like the Manchester bombing with these young kids being murdered, blown up, the idea is in part not just the act of terror itself, but also to drive a wedge between the Muslims in the diaspora and the host countries to provoke the very kind of a hate crime that we witnessed in Finsbury, in front of the Finsbury Mosque, and in Virginia, outside, just outside of Washington, D.C.
Yes, absolutely. One of the self-proclaimed so-called Islamic State strategies has been to foster a clash of civilizations that they see as both inevitable and welcome. They see this clash of civilizations in apocalyptic terms. They think it's going to bring upon the end of the world, and God will bring upon a day of judgment at that point, and they'll be saved, and all of their enemies will be damned. And so their strategy has been quite openly to try to generate revenge attacks, tit-for-tat violence, and as you say, hate crimes and extremism against Muslims, which feeds the narrative that Muslims and non-Muslims cannot live together peacefully, they cannot coexist. In fact, they had a phrase for Muslims living in the West peacefully, who they called the gray zone. They believed the gray zone had to be eradicated. All this coexistence and peaceful talk was anathema to them. The gray zone would be eradicated, they felt, by increased awareness of anti-Islamic sentiments in the West and by whatever violence they could trigger, both by Muslims against non-Muslims and vice versa. All of which is part of their long-term strategy. It's disconcerting to see some folks playing into that, I have to say.
Well, is this likely then to increase as the Islamic State itself is under siege and is being reduced both in Raqqa and Mosul? I mean, there's a kind of paradox in the very nature of how they operate and what their ideology is, and that is that they, on the one hand, they are heavily invested in martyrdom, but on the other hand, they have this grandiose idea of a caliphate. So I guess the idea that you prepare to die at any moment, but not want to, you know, not necessarily live to see the caliphate. At this point, what would be going on, in your estimation, with these people who feel they literally are reaching the end of time, the end days for them? What do you think is that likely to lead to more acts of desperation as opposed to their earlier riding high across the desert in their pickup trucks, taking over large swaths of territory?
They've had both plans in action since they started to take territory from Al-Qaeda's Syrian affiliate in late 2013 and early 2014. Remember the Islamic State's origins. It was Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Iraq. It got pushed out of Iraq and then fled to Syria and fought with another Al-Qaeda affiliate, got kicked out of Al-Qaeda, and has set up their own network. Both taking territory, physical territory, and trying to either arrange or inspire acts of violence around the world have been part of their plan then since that time. What's changed, I think, is that they've been unable to get recruits in large numbers since the middle of 2015, in large part because Turkey shut down its border. There had been some back and forth across the Turkish-Syrian border for the previous year. They decided, Turkey itself decided it had had enough, started to shut down that border. And then we've seen relatively few people from the West and from elsewhere travel to join IS since that time. Here in the U.S., the numbers dropped off precipitously in July 2015 and have not recovered. And that's been noted by the FBI for the past over more than a year. So yes, they, while they're trying to defend territory, have been trying all along to inspire violence and wreak havoc around the world. And I want to point out just how unsuccessful they've been. I mean, they've been trying hard. They've sent out instructions on how to build bombs and how to run people over with cars and how to attack people with knives and all sorts of horrible things that are sort of, if you think about it, kind of easy to do. And, you know, anybody with a car can run folks over and say it was, you know, in the name of God. And it hasn't happened all that often. And I you know, when incidents of violence occur, I try to keep in mind, you know, that just how rare they are as compared with both with what we were, have been for years bracing for in terms of waves of violence since 9/11 and since the rise of the Islamic State, and also how rare these events are in terms of other forms of violence that we have in the United States. You know, there's about approximately 15,000 murders a year. And so ideological extremism, whether it's Muslims or non-Muslims, accounts for a tiny, tiny proportion of that, even though we give it, you know, a disproportionate amount of attention. And the same is true with different numbers, but the same ratios hold in the UK and elsewhere outside of these civil war zones where, of course, the ideological violence is extreme and rampant. The rest of the world, fortunately, just doesn't see this kind of thing all that often. And that's true also for this anti-Muslim violence. You know, it's to be condemned. I am not excusing it in any way. But let's point out, you know, there's been a lot of anti-Muslim sentiment out there. Relatively rarely does it turn into violence. And so let's denounce it. But let's not inflame the situation further by blowing it out of proportion. You know, ideological extremism does not turn violent all that often, thank goodness, you know.
And again, I'm speaking with Charles Kurzman, a professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and co-director of the Carolina Center for the Study of Middle East and Muslim Civilizations. He is the author of The Missing Martyrs and The Unthinkable Revolution in Iran and the editor of the anthologies Liberal Islam and Modernist Islam, 1840 to 1940. So the person who ran down the worshippers in front of the mosque in Finsbury Park in London, turns out his name is Daryl Osborne. He's a 47-year-old father of four children, and he was actually got out of the van. It's unsure whether the person who died was actually suffering from some kind of seizure or something or heart attack before, or whether the actual van incident killed him or not. There's some doubt about that. But he was chased down by the worshippers and held. The police came. And he basically was heard to say, you know, I did my bit. As though, you know, something like going back to the Battle of Britain in World War II, you know, heeding Winston Churchill's call. I mean, what an extraordinary thing to think for a father of young children that he could run down a bunch of people because his belief in whatever. I mean, what worries me is that in the U.S. context is that we've already seen these massive demonstrations that took place recently in support of Donald Trump, where most of the people holding up signs against Sharia law. So we already have over here in this country a very distorted idea about what the Muslims are up to. The idea that you have to pass laws against Sharia taking over the country is absurd. But people believe that. So it seems to me that we're in a very combustible situation with that kind of ignorance prevailing.
Yeah, that we've seen there's considerable evidence of polarization of attitudes towards Muslims in the United States. I've tracked survey data on this over a number of years. And the number of people who self-identify as Democrats or as liberals and who say they have unfavorable views of Muslims has gone up slightly over the past decade. But the percentage of people who self-identify as Republicans or conservatives who have unfavorable attitudes towards Muslims has more than doubled. It's now more than half of respondents in most surveys. This group of respondents say they have unfavorable attitudes towards Muslims. There was one small survey that asked, should Islam be legal or illegal in the United States? And despite the fervent beliefs about the freedom of religion in the United States, 40% of registered Republicans in that survey said Islam should be illegal in the United States, and another 20% said they weren't sure, suggesting that there is a feeling that the normal rules, the protection of law, constitutional rights, and so on, don't apply to Muslims, that the threat somehow is seen as so severe that some of these cherished values are being cast aside. That is very troubling, and it's even more troubling that it's based on a fiction, because Muslims in the United States, like Muslims in the UK, are not trying to impose Sharia. Let's just be honest about it, that they are law-abiding citizens of the United States. There's very little evidence that their movements towards even voluntary self-application of arbitration standards, for example, as some religious minority communities do, where they'll enter into arbitration agreements, and the religious law of that community, whether it's Jews or some other group, would apply then and by the consent of the parties. Very few Muslims engage in that kind of arbitration, and to the idea that Muslims are going to impose somehow that 1% of the population is going to be imposing its religious beliefs and laws on the rest, the 99%, hard to imagine how anybody would take that seriously. And yet there are campaigns, active campaigns out there to try to demonize Muslims and gain political capital by it. It is a wedge issue to suggest that the country and the civilization, Western civilization itself, is under siege and under attack. I think we should see those for what they are, which is desperate and fraudulent attempts to sow hatred and to undermine our core values, our values of freedom and liberty that include an acknowledgement of diversity, which the founding figures of the United States acknowledged themselves. Go back to the origin story of the United States. That's why we don't have an established church in the United States.
Well, do you think, though, that given these demonstrations are under the kind of banner of pro-Trump rallies, that the president himself has clearly sent some messages that people who are not necessarily sophisticated and educated about what Islam's about and how Muslim Americans are law-abiding, hardworking people who have no plans to take over the world. As you point out, you were talking about 1%. And he's obviously called for a Muslim ban, and the courts have struck it down repeatedly. But nevertheless, is he creating the atmosphere, or is he? He's certainly not doing what should be done, surely. And even moral issues aside, I would have thought that his Homeland Security people would be saying to Trump, look, we need the cooperation of the Muslim communities to let us know if somebody within their midst is becoming radicalized, which seems to be the only line of defense we have against these homegrown terrorist acts.
I wouldn't say that's the only line. I think there's lots of lines of defense. The community is one of them. And let's keep in mind that Muslims are not the only homegrown terrorists in the United States. There are also right-wing extremists who turn violent and left-wing extremists who turn violent, as we saw with the attack on the congressman last week. So let's not put everything on the Muslim community. But your point is valid, that of course community members have to be part of the solution and have been. So there are numerous cases of Muslims suspecting somebody of radicalization and seeking help from law enforcement to deal with that. And one of the issues I think we have with the new administration is the question of whether evidence and to what extent evidence plays a role at all in policymaking. And if evidence of the need for assistance, the need for community outreach and so on are important, I don't think we would have heard about cuts and potential cuts in programs of community outreach from the Department of Homeland Security that we heard about a couple months ago. We still haven't seen yet a change in policy or budgets, hard numbers that would reflect that. But the signs were not encouraging. You mentioned President Trump's own statements on these issues. And the Muslim ban is these travel from seven, now six countries to be paused, is part of a long-standing campaign that Trump has had to that views Muslims as unwelcome in the United States. Going back to, let's not forget, he became a political phenomenon in part because he latched on to the question of whether President Obama was Muslim, whether he was born outside the U.S. All of this sort of othering of Muslims has gone on for quite a while. And during his campaign, beginning in the middle of 2015, when he announced, Muslims were sort of the butt of a running, riff on problems facing America, people who shouldn't be here was a phrase that he used frequently, along with Mexicans and other groups. Those words have come back to bite him now because the courts have said that's part of the discriminatory intent, potentially, that undermines the constitutionality of these policies that would ban or at least pause the issuance of visas of people from certain countries. But one wonders. I mean, he's never gone back on those words to say, oh, I'm sorry, that was just campaign talk, I didn't mean it. And so we really have no sense of leadership on this core value of inclusiveness from the top. It's not that he created these sentiments. He certainly helped to fan them and has benefited from them. But there's lots of folks out there who have been stoking this message for some years that Muslims in the U.S. are somehow a threat to the rest of the country. It's never been true on a large scale, and it's disingenuous. And I think we need to stand up for our core values, which includes respecting our Muslim neighbors just as we respect non-Muslim neighbors.
Well, Charles Kurzban, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Charles Kurzban, who's a professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and the co-director of the Carolina Center for the Study of Middle East and Muslim Civilizations. He's the author of The Missing Martyrs and the Unthinkable Revolution in Iran and the editor of the anthologies Liberal Islam and Modernist Islam, 1840 to 1940. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Disappeared by